from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush spoke today at the United Nations to an audience filled with people he has been publicly at odds with for much of the past 4 years. By turns proud and conciliatory, Bush highlighted the United States' participation in international efforts to fight AIDS, malaria, and human trafficking, defended U.S. actions in Iraq, and challenged the U.N. members to provide more support to Iraq's fledgling government. He tied the war on terror to a struggle for freedom around the globe.
For decades, the circle of liberty and security and development has been expanding in our world. This progress has brought unity to Europe, self-government to Latin America and Asia, and new hope to Africa. Now we have the historic chance to widen the circle even further, to fight radicalism and terror with justice and dignity, to achieve a true peace founded on human freedom.
The tone of the president's speech 6 weeks before the election was less confrontational than his addresses at past UN visits, but there was a silent gulf of skepticism in the hall today that was almost palpable. Whether it can be bridged and how much George Bush believes he needs to bridge that gulf remain open questions. Tonight on Point, George W. Bush at the UN and America in the world, the president's message and the global response. What did you see President Bush working to accomplish in New York today? Did it work? In nearly 4 years now, what has the Bush administration signaled it expects from the United Nations? And does the UN look ready to support George Bush's call for the democratic remaking of the Middle East? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Boston Globe national political correspondent Ann Kornblut, who was at Bush's UN address today. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. How are you?
I'm great. So give us a sense of the hall today in and after the speech of around the UN today. What kind of response were you seeing, hearing, Ann?
We had a little personnel swap today. So my other colleague who was with me at the Globe, Rick Klein, actually was in the hall, but we talked just right afterwards.
Okay.
I will tell you what he told me, just so we're upfront about it.
Great.
It was probably the quietest reception the president has gotten in about a year since the last time he spoke at the UN. There were polite golf applause. They were warned ahead of time not to interrupt the speech with applause, but when they feel like ignoring that, they often do. Applause afterwards. And, you know, in the hall, you have to remember they are listening through translators, many
right,
of them.
Right, sure.
And so there's not as much of an opportunity for a response, but apparently the looks on their faces did not show any great pleasure with him, you know, even though he was more conciliatory, as you mentioned in your introduction, than he has been in the past.
And you've been traveling with the Bush campaign for months now. What about President Bush himself, his body language, his tone, his twang today, not on the stump with an American audience, but with this global audience?
Well, he did try to tone it down somewhat. Gone from his speech were remarks about not asking anyone for a permission slip to defend the United States. That gets big applause on the campaign trail, and especially in front of Republican audiences who are suspicious of the United Nations. That was not in the speech today, and nor were his somewhat derisive comments about foreign leaders that he's made about John Kerry in the past. We still, though, we saw him, you know, talking about the world community needing to rally around Iraq and setting the stage for what I think we're going to see the rest of the week here, which is really holding up Prime Minister Alawi as the one who needs to be helped and using him as the one who is really going to appeal for world support at the UN.
And, of course, Prime Minister Alawi will himself address the UN later this week. Did it seem that President Bush sincerely wants more UN help? There's been some ambivalence about UN involvement, international involvement in the past in this administration. Does he seem to be making a genuine appeal today?
Absolutely. I think they do want the help. They just don't want to surrender any control over matters there. And, you know, we've heard some concern on their part, especially since the UN pulled out so many of its people after the bombing last year, about a year ago now, that Bush referenced in his speech also, I would
mm-hmm.
mention.
Right.
There's been some concern that they aren't getting the kind of support they need there, financial, military, or otherwise. So, yes, I do think that it's very genuine, that wanting the support of the UN, but they're not going to turn it over to UN control by any means.
So President Bush at the UN and now gone. Is there more arm twisting ahead? We saw Colin Powell in the audience today with Condoleezza Rice. Is there a campaign to follow up on what the president's saying today or not? What do you know, Ann?
Yes, absolutely. And they'll be doing it on two fronts. I mean, they'll be doing it in the press and they'll be doing it at the UN. President Bush is still here also. And he's leaving tomorrow, but he's going to another event. So he's had two nights of dinners and meetings. He had a toast today with Kofi Annan. So he is not just blown through town, as I suspect he might have wanted to. And then on Thursday, he will have a press conference at the White House with Alawi.
And what about, I'm sorry, but what about Kofi Annan's implicit, almost explicit challenge to the U.S. president today in his speech before Bush's remarks, looking at where he referenced Abu Ghraib. He talked about the need of everyone to obey international law. Were those taken as affronts or challenges by the Bush team?
No more so than his accusation last week that the war in Iraq was illegal. Look, he's a thorn in their side. They were very angry about his comments last week that the war in Iraq was illegal. So I don't think they were surprised by it. I also don't think they really see the need to respond to it.
And John Kerry, of course, kicking out again today on Bush and Iraq, saying the president has no credibility, he can't really lead. Did the White House respond to Kerry's remarks?
They did. President Bush himself did. He said that he had a small press availability, and he said that Kerry has no credibility when it comes to Iraq. They really heated up. It's just when you think the campaign can't get any hotter, it does. And they're taking Kerry's new offensive very seriously. They're trying to portray him still as a flip-flopper, but I think they realize that he has, in fact, settled on a message, and they're responding very forcefully to that.
Ann, thanks a lot for joining us tonight from New York.
Thank you.
Ann Kornblut, national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. We are talking tonight about George Bush at the UN and America in the world, the president's vision and the world's wary response. Let's hear a little bit more of George Bush before the United Nations today, here talking about how every nation, he said, has a stake in actively advancing democracy across the world.
Every nation that wants peace will share the benefits of a freer world. And every nation that seeks peace has an obligation to help build that world. Eventually, there is no safe isolation from terror networks or failed states that shelter them or outlaw regimes or weapons of mass destruction. Eventually, there is no safety in looking away, seeking the quiet life by ignoring the struggles and oppression of others. In this young century, our world needs a new definition of security. Our security is not merely found in spheres of influence or some balance of power. The security of our world is found in the advancing rights of mankind.
President Bush at the UN today. You can join our conversation tonight. What did you see and hear President Bush trying to accomplish in New York today? Was he persuasive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined right now from Washington by Ken Weinstein. He is vice president of the conservative Hudson Institute. He's a frequent contributor to The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard. Ken Weinstein, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening.
And joining us from McLean, Virginia, Lee Feinstein, deputy director of studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a former Clinton administration defense and State Department official. Lee Feinstein, thank you for being with us.
Happy to join you.
Ken Weinstein, to you first. What did you hear in the president's speech today? What was he reaching for? What's he trying for with this address to the UN?
Sure. I think what the president is trying to do is obviously he's speaking to three audiences. One is a domestic audience with the elections coming up. The second is a broader international audience. And third is a more select international audience, in particular in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and other nations that are particularly touched by the war on terror. The president's message, I think, is a pretty clear one. That's to say that the United States is committed to the founding ideals of the United Nations, the ideas in the Declaration of Human Rights, the idea that there is some sort of a moral law that stands above men and above nations that has to be enforced, and that the basis of that law is free and democratic, or free and democratic societies across the globe, and that his future vision of the world is one in which he would like to see democracy and human rights more spread out throughout the world, And what he is trying to do through his speech at the UN is to offer this vision and to note that it is time for the UN to start doing more to promote human rights and democracy, and to do more to make sure that human rights are more strongly defended. Hence his notion for the creation of a democracy fund to promote human rights and civil liberties. And this speech has this domestic audience, which is one that appeals to, if it's heard, will appeal to those who have a concern for human rights, who are perhaps concerned about the war on terror, are sort of less desirous of a future American intervention in the short term, and an international audience both in Europe and elsewhere, to remind people that the United States really does not deserve to be caricatured as badly as it has been in much of the international press. And finally, obviously, in those countries that have suffered through tyrannical regimes and have recently had regime change, to show that the future is something that the United States is working on.
So less red meat today, more statesmanship, a big vision of the United Nations pulling in real strong behind promoting democracy. Lee Feinstein, can this president, given his history with the United Nations, his taunting of the United Nations, his going to war without the Security Council blessing, can he be a persuasive representative of the view that he brought to New York today?
Well, frankly, I don't know what view the president brought to New York today. This was really a non-speech. George Bush wanted to be anywhere but New York today. But, you know, every year there's a UN General Assembly speech, and every year the president of the United States comes to New York and gives a speech. But, you know, this is something that George Bush did not want to be doing.
Why not? You heard the three audiences Ken Weinstein is describing, and certainly the president would like to speak to all those audiences, I would think.
Well, look. You know, the elephant in the room was Iraq. The president spoke about Iraq as little as he could. And that's because 2 years ago he went to the United Nations to challenge it to live up to its responsibilities. The UN has failed to do so. That's the responsibility of several members of the UN, but also a failure of American leadership. It was just 3 months ago that the UN Security Council, at the behest of the United Nations, approved a resolution for the transition to Iraqi rule, which would call for a variety of steps by the UN, first and foremost, to get the UN back in Iraq. Let's not forget that the UN isn't really operating in Iraq now.
They got their headquarters blown up last summer and left.
Exactly. And Kofi Annan has been prepared to send them back if there's a protection force for UN workers. That was what was called for in Security Council Resolution 1543, which the Bush administration trumpeted as a major accomplishment. Well, 3 months later, not one country has volunteered for this force. It's only 4,000 troops, not one country. And despite what your reporter colleague said earlier, this administration has made no serious diplomatic effort to marshal international support for this protection force or really any other aspect of their Iraq policy.
Even though so much depends on these elections in January, we're told, and these elections are supposed to be overseen by the United Nations.
Well, it's not only that they'll be overseen, it's that in order to have the infrastructure to carry out the elections, there's a lot of preparatory work you need to be doing. And the UN has a lot of expertise in this area, but they're not operating inside Iraq except for the leadership cell, and that's because Kofi Annan can't afford to have his people blown up again.
So who are you pinning this on? Are you saying the UN isn't rising to the challenge, or that George Bush doesn't really want them there?
Look, other countries rise to the challenge when there's leadership, and that leadership, you know, fair or not, needs to be provided by the United States. This administration is not providing that leadership, and it's for a variety of reasons. I have to conclude, and I didn't feel this way 2 years ago, but I do feel this way now, that the administration's appeal for international support was primarily for domestic political consumption, that their conclusion about Iraq is it's better to go it alone than to have international support, because international support would dilute American authority.
Even now, when it's so costly. Lee Feinstein, Ken Weinstein, stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about George Bush at the UN and America in the world. You can join the conversation. What did you see? What did you hear President Bush trying to accomplish in New York today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Bush at the UN today and America in the world today, the president's vision and the world's wary response. I've been joined by Ken Weinstein of the Hudson Institute and Lee Feinstein at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can join the conversation as well. Does the UN look ready to support George Bush's call for the democratic remaking of the Middle East, starting in Iraq? What do you think was going through the minds of the UN representatives listening to Bush today? Can Washington lead a world that every poll indicates is deeply alienated by many of its policies? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. George Bush made a plea again today to members of the UN to increase their support in Iraq. Let's listen.
Since the last meeting of this General Assembly, the people of Iraq have regained sovereignty. Today in this hall, the Prime Minister of Iraq and his delegation represent a country that has rejoined the community of nations. The government of Prime Minister Alawi has earned the support of every nation that believes in self-determination and desires peace. And under Security Council Resolutions 1511, and 1546, the world is providing that support. The UN and its member nations must respond to Prime Minister Alawi's request and do more to help build an Iraq that is secure, democratic, federal, and free. A democratic Iraq has ruthless enemies because terrorists know the stakes in that country. They know that a free Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a decisive blow against their ambitions for that region.
George Bush at the United Nations today. Ken Weinstein, what about the polls we read, and you've seen them as well, of public opinion polls in countries around the world, just country after country indicating opposition to U.S. policy, general foreign policy under George Bush. Where does that put the president when he stands before the United Nations, of which he's been quite critical, when he reaches out for help? Does he stand a chance of getting it?
Well, he stands a chance of getting some help, but the truth is, clearly, as was mentioned earlier, that this is clearly not the president's favorite venue for public speaking. And it's something that's not totally to be surprised. We have to remember that a large number of countries in the United States in themselves are not democratic. Even among those that are democratic, there has been some opposition to the Iraq policy and other.
To say the least, there's been substantial opposition, I guess.
To other parts of American foreign policy. So it is not a friendly venue for the president. That being said, he can still make a case that the United Nations should live up to some degree to some of its founding principles, and it is still a useful venue for discussing various international issues.
Lee Feinstein, I heard the president, if I understood him correctly today, almost suggesting that the UN needs to redefine its own focus away from the post-World War II just sort of sovereignty issues and toward an active promotion of democracy. Is that an idea in Bush's mind alone? Is there a constituency for that?
Well, first of all, you described what President Bush said as a plea. I would describe it as a peep. I think that the president has, really backed off. And if you were serious about trying to get international support, you would take your Secretary of State and you would not only have him meet people, on the margins of the General Assembly, but you would, have a worldwide tour. And you would make a major effort to do something. The Bush administration has done this on things that it considers important. For example, when it wanted to break out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty to create a national missile defense, mm-hmm. It sent its senior leaders all around the world to tell others what they were planning to do.
And so you just don't buy the international outreach at all? You don't think it's genuine?
I don't think it's genuine, no. I think that it is done because there's an understanding that the administration is very vulnerable on this point. Americans are concerned that the United States is shouldering the burden basically alone, 90% of the troops, 90% of the casualties are U.S., and that's a real vulnerability, and that's a real cost of the administration's foreign policy. So when his opponent, John Kerry, says, you know, you need more allied support, the president understands he needs to do something about that. But it's really, at this point, just lip service.
I want to turn to Andrew Buncombe. He joins us from Milwaukee. He's Washington correspondent for the Independent newspaper of London. Andrew Buncombe, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
No, my pleasure.
Give us a bit of a perspective from the other side of the Atlantic here. Of course, Tony Blair has been side by side with George Bush, but public opinion in the UK and many other European nations has not been. How do you think George Bush's speech at the UN today will be received among European allies?
Well, what struck me was just how much things have changed in the last 3 years. I remember going to the General Assembly meeting in 2001. It was in the aftermath of September 11th. And I was struck then, in contrast to what one of your earlier contributors said, that it wasn't a friendly venue. On the contrary, it was an incredibly friendly venue. There was a vast amount of international support in the aftermath of 9/11. I remember one French newspaper, its headline was, we are all now Americans.
Of course, we all remember that, but it seems a long time ago.
In 3 years, that's been squandered, and there's one reason for that, and that has been the Bush administration's decision to go it alone, to act in what has been seen as an arrogant fashion, and to go to war in Iraq. Whether you agree with that action or not, whether you support it or not, it was done preemptively. There was Britain there and a handful of other nations, Poland, Italy, a few others, but essentially done alone. And I think, we see that what the action of that has been, the outcome of that has been.
So is it all over? Are the bridges all burned down? Is George Bush just going through the motions here? Or is there still a chance for him to say, look, we need help here. We need stability in the Middle East. Come on board.
Well, I don't want to draw a line under anything, but I mean, I think, actions happen when people believe people are serious. If people believe people are seriously asking for help, then it happens. I dare say that the international community could still come on board in Iraq, but one doesn't get the impression that the U.S. is seeking this. I think back to earlier this year in the Rose Garden when Mr. Bush surprised Tony Blair, perhaps his closest ally, over Israel and Mr. Sharon's decision to continue settlement building. Completely wrong-footed Tony Blair, completely wrong-footed what he and Europe have been working on for the last 2 years. So I'm not quite sure what sort of payback that is. I just don't get the sense that Mr. Bush is particularly serious about international support. I think that's one of the slim areas, perhaps, in which people see a difference between him and John Kerry. Let's be honest about it. America is a superpower. It can go it alone. It doesn't really need to, seek international support. But the one difference, slim difference I see between them in foreign policy terms is that John Kerry has made a point of saying we will seek international support where we can and when we can.
There's another note of skepticism about the whole call for international support. Andrew Buncombe, come with The Independent. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight from Milwaukee.
My pleasure.
President Bush spent a lot of time today talking about democracy at the UN, saying it's a universal, appealing to the UN to sort of build its own project on striving for democracy.
Because we believe in human dignity, peaceful nations must stand for the advance of democracy. No other system of government has done more to protect minorities, to secure the rights of labor, to raise the status of women, or to channel human energy to the pursuits of peace. We have witnessed the rise of democratic governments in predominantly Hindu and Muslim, Buddhist, Jewish, and Christian cultures. Democratic institutions have taken root in modern societies and in traditional societies. When it comes to the desire for liberty and justice, there is no clash of civilizations. People everywhere are capable of freedom and worthy of freedom. Finding the full promise of representative government takes time, as America has found in two centuries of debate and struggle. Nor is there only one form of representative government, because democracies, by definition, take on the unique character of the peoples that create them. Yet this much we know with certainty. The desire for freedom resides in every human heart.
President Bush at the UN today. Ken Weinstein, to you, you talked about the three audiences that President Bush is addressing, the political audience at home, the electorate, the sort of global audience, and then Iraq and Afghanistan in particular. What's the point of this? Is this boilerplate, or is he really trying to push something pointed on democracy?
No, I think he's trying to push something pointed. What he's saying is that the United Nations founding principles were clear. What was much clearer at the time of the founding of the United Nations was a focus on human rights, on individual rights, and protecting those rights in the aftermath of the Second World War. Instead, what we've seen is an organization that has grown up and placed its sovereign, its focus largely on protecting sovereignty, and to some degree, implicitly protecting the international, both the international and the domestic status quo in places where tyrants have been allowed free rein, where the UN has not been especially effective, and where non-democratic governments control a disproportionate share of the vote in the General Assembly. And so what the president wants to do is to shift the focus more to the human rights vision that he believes in and that he would like the UN to come to be reformed and to take more of a focus on individual rights. And this is a clear message that he believes in. He realizes this is a long-term strategy. This is not something that's going to be achieved overnight, and he's certainly not naive about this being a friendly audience at all or this being a friendly Secretary General. The president also is also clear about the need for reforming the internal dynamics of the United Nations, particularly in the aftermath of the oil for food scandal, which has shown both tremendous incompetence at the UN General, at the Secretariat of the United Nations, which has frankly grown to discredit the organization in the eyes of many as literally billions of dollars in this oil for food program that was destined to feed starving Iraqis and under Saddam Hussein's regime were taken in some cases we do not know what was done with the money. In other cases, money that was supposed to be destined for food apparently went to build stadiums in Iraq with the authorization of officials from the General Secretariat, apparently.
Yeah, that was not a pretty picture.
This is the kind of thing that discredits the United Nations and at least the kind of skepticism that many in the United States, frankly, feel towards this organization, which should be serving the kind of higher purposes that the president outlined.
The president there taking his final or latest rationale for the war in Iraq, that is to bring democracy there and wrapping it around the entire war on terror, around his outreach to the UN. I want to turn to our callers. Eric is calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I thought that the Assembly was pretty much aghast that Bush would even think about having elections under the current situation. He totally was in total denial about the situation on the ground.
In Iraq.
Yeah, everybody's commented on that. But I think also that I agree with your earlier guess that the Bush administration doesn't want international support. What they want to do is go through the motions, and I think there's a lot of back-channeling going on right now in the international community about the Bush administration's intentions towards Iran and Syria. Who wants to get drawn into that? I think the Bush administration, in consultation with their reluctant Joint Chiefs of Staff, who've told them they can fight wars on three fronts, I think they're perfectly willing to carry their Pax Americana campaign all the way through. I think everybody recognizes that. And no, Bush does not want international support. He wants to go through the motions. He wants to ask for sanctions. And then I think a preemptive manufactured incident in Iran is somewhere down the line.
Over the horizon. And, of course, more word on the nuclear front out of Iran today. Eric, thanks for your call. Lee Feinstein, how about it? This war in Iraq is very expensive. The U.S. military is clearly stretched. There's talk of the need potentially for another call-up after the election. I mean, is the idea of wanting, needing, asking for international help so distasteful that this government just wouldn't do it or doesn't need it?
Well, first of all, let me see if I can address the democracy point and the related point about Kofi Annan. First of all, in terms of recent secretary generals, the United States has never had a better friend and a more supportive secretary general than Kofi Annan. And I think it is a shame that this administration hasn't found a better way to work with him. And on the question of democracy, this secretary general has really broken from the orthodoxy that my colleague at the Hudson Institute described. And in 2000, Secretary Albright and I worked for her and traveled with her to the first Community of Democracies meeting, which took place in Warsaw, Poland, in June of 2000. And the Secretary General appeared there and talked about how democracy was in some ways the critical component of being a member in good standing at the UN, which goes against all of the old world stuff about sovereignty that people criticize the UN for. So I think Kofi Annan is certainly supportive of what of that part of the president's speech, which I think was very eloquent. That said, it doesn't look to me like the president is really following through on that. You know, for example, as you pointed out, in Iraq, we've got a situation where credible elections can't be held in January as they're supposed to be.
Though President Bush and Prime Minister Alawi are not conceding this.
They're not conceding it, but everybody else from the CIA to the Secretary of State believe that this is the case. And in Afghanistan, you know, we have a situation of warlordism. The Bush administration is cutting back funding to Afghanistan for reconstruction and other assistance programs which would help to establish the basis for credible elections and the building of institutions. He's cut funding for reconstruction to Afghanistan by 45% next year. And, you know, to take another example, in Russia, you know, in the name of support for the United States on terrorism, this president has looked the other way as Putin has turned back the clock and basically transformed Russia from a developing democracy, very imperfect one, to what looks like the rebirth of authoritarianism in Russia with nuclear weapons.
And some very emotional outreach today in his speech before the UN to Russia, strong references to the terrorism at Beslan.
Right.
Ken Weinstein, well, here's Lee Feinstein saying, you know, sticking to it. They don't really want the international help. They don't really need it, and they should value Kofi Annan, even if President Bush doesn't, because he's on board with his democracy theme.
Well, he was on board generally, and I think one of the reasons why the administration has chosen this democracy theme is to stick it to Kofi Annan to some degree, to sort of remind him of the principles that he so eloquently enunciated, as Lee Feinstein said earlier in 2000, and that this is one of the reasons why they have decided to highlight this issue, is to remind Annan of where he stood on this issue a few years ago, and to say that this is an area that we can work together. I mean, there are certain areas where international cooperation does seem to be playing a positive role in the United Nations, with regard to Darfur, for example. Our Security Council resolution, there has been condemnation of what has gone on there. The question is how to go out and take a specific action against the genocide that is taking place there.
Always tough with the UN. Ken Lee, please stand by. We're talking about George Bush at the UN tonight. You can join the conversation. Was this the speech of a realist, an idealist, a utopian, a savvy politician running for re-election? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush at the United Nations today and America in the world, the president's vision, and the world's response to that vision. Of course, it is a political season. The president, well aware of that, as he spoke at the United Nations today. John Kerry, aware of that, in his response within hours of the president's speech. Let's listen to a little bit of John Kerry's pushback today.
At the United Nations today, the president failed to level with the world's leaders. Moments after Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, talked about the difficulties in Iraq, the President of the United States stood before a stony-faced body and barely talked about the realities at all of Iraq. After lecturing them instead of leading them to understand how we are all together with a stake in the outcome of Iraq, I believe the president missed an opportunity of enormous importance for our nation and for the world. He does not have the credibility to lead the world, and he did not and will not offer the leadership in order to do what we need to do to protect our troops, to be successful, and win the war on terror in an effective way.
John Kerry responding to George Bush's UN speech today. Central to the president's speech, an appeal to the world to step in and help the United States transform the Middle East, starting with Iraq and Afghanistan as models for democracy that could grow there. We're joined now by Shibli Telhami. He's Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East. Shibli Telhami, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So you heard the president's big focus on the Middle East and its transformation, even as he stood before the representatives of many nations there who presumably would be in the path of that transformation. How is this message likely to go down in the Middle East, the region that got the most attention today?
Look, the best interpretation of this speech is that it was oriented to the American people, because if it weren't, the gap between what he said and reality is so huge that, clearly it seemed detached from where people were psychologically, both at the UN and in the Middle East. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
In my surveys, when you look at the degree of trust in the U.S., it's now in the single digit in the six Arab countries that I studied recently.
Okay.
When you look at, you ask them, do you believe that the Iraqis are better off today than they were before the war? The majority in every single one of these countries says that Iraqis are worse off. When you ask them, do you believe that there is more or less democracy in the Middle East broadly now after the Iraq war? They believe that there is less. When you ask them, are the prospects of peace better or worse? They say they're far worse. When you ask them what American intentions are, do you believe the U.S. is trying to spread democracy?
Mm.
The vast majority say no. When you ask them, do you think it's human rights? The vast majority say no. So ultimately, there is a complete collapse of trust. There is no faith in the intentions of the administration. So when they hear human rights, what flashes in their minds is Abu Ghraib. When they hear democracy in Iraq and they're seeing on their screen, on Al Jazeera and every other satellite,
yeah,
what we see and more, clearly that's not their interpretation.
Shibli Telhami, let me ask you, you know, President Bush, in the line he's been working lately, might respond to that. Look, it's not pretty, it's not easy, but we're going to come out of the other end here with working democracies in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they will be attractive.
How are you going to persuade people to stay with you through this bloodshed, to be patient with you, to trust you, when they have no faith? That's the problem. When you got to a point where, in essence, a war that was waged against their wishes, they opposed it, in a situation where they can tell you, I told you so, because that's what they predicted in my service prior to the war. And now we're saying, now trust me again, after we didn't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It doesn't look like democracy is about to happen tomorrow. I mean, the promise is maybe down the road. And we have had what we've had, the ugly pictures in Abu Ghraib. It's very hard to come to people now and say, oh, just stick with me. Stick with me a little bit longer, and we're going to transform it. I believe that people in the Middle East want liberty, by the way.
Yeah.
I think that's one issue in which the president is absolutely right. They want liberty. Nobody loves authoritarianism. But right now, Iraq has become what I call a scare tool in the hands of authoritarian governments. They look at the public and say, would you rather have that you see on your screen in Iraq? Would you rather have what we have with me? And you know what? Most people are terrified by the Iraqi events.
A scare tool in the hands of despots in the Middle East. Shibli Telhami, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Shibli Telhami, author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East. David is calling from Bel Air, Michigan. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks, David.
I have a couple of quick, or just one quick question, and it has to do with Bush reaching out to Europe. How is it possible that Europe can look at his speech today and say this is the real man, when all his campaign rhetoric and everything else he's speaking about points away from a conciliatory attitude?
That we're never going to ask for permission from anybody to do anything, that line.
Yeah, I mean, the two positions that he's taken are pretty much seems to me to be diametrically opposed. And the other thing I'd like to say, which is kind of an add-on, listening to the gentleman just now, how can we tell the Arab people that we're so for democracy and human rights when at the same time when Ariel Sharon comes up and says, we're going to deny the Palestinian people the right to return to their homes that they left as refugees, which is direct violation. I think it's UN resolution.
But that aside, David, you've got 1,000 U.S. troops that have died in Iraq. Might that not look like an investment in democracy, a genuine commitment? That's a lot of Americans.
Well, I know, and I understand that, but I also understand that there are a lot of Americans who feel the only reason we're there is for oil. that it doesn't. I mean, we turned our back on Iraqi human rights abuses for years and years and years. When we were there in 91 and we had the chance to actually stop the abuses of the Shiites, we
yep.
stopped instead and watched as Saddam Hussein's helicopters swooped in and massacred them.
David, we've got it. And we do remember. Thank you for your call. Lee Feinstein, how about this disconnect between the president's tone and message today before the diplomats and his tone and message on the stump before Americans? It's a small, global, wired world. Everybody hears all this stuff, so there's really no secret there, even for U.N. representatives from far away.
Well, I think that the primary audience for this speech was domestic, as far as the president is concerned, and all the president wanted to do with this speech was to get it over with. He did not want to have a clear theme. He did not want people to remember this speech. He wanted to get in and get out with as little damage as possible. This was a trial to be endured by the president, not a place where he wanted to put points on the board. Or anything of the kind. He had to give the speech. He gave it. He hopes that nobody remembers it. That's basically what this speech was about. If the Bush administration were serious or were to become serious about building international support to promote democracy, human rights, to deal with the global threats that the president talked about, such as HIV, AIDS, and malaria, an American president can do that. Even this American president, in my judgment, could do it. It would be very, very difficult because of the credibility loss that this administration has helped to create. But I think if the United States has a lot of credibility in the world. The world, although it doesn't always, it's not always evident, is looking for American leadership. It's not looking to be dictated to, but it's looking for American leadership. And good things can't really happen unless the United States is helping that to happen.
Ken Weinstein, we've just got a minute left, but imagine a second Bush term, entirely possible. Do you see a change in the U.S. posture toward the U.N., toward the larger world community? Would it be 4 more years of Washington essentially going it alone? Is there room to turn around?
Look, I really want to deny that we're going it alone. The United States provides almost 60% of the aid to the World Food Program. It provides a huge proportion of the funding for the for AIDS relief, et cetera. It's the High Commissioner of Refugees. United States gave almost $400 million last year.
Council did not vote for the Iraq intervention. I guess that's what I mean.
There have only been two wars that have been supported by the United Nations since its existence. Period. The 1991 Iraq War and the Korean War. And the Korean War happened because the Russians were on the Security Council at that point. But the bottom line is that the United States is even working with France recently on a referendum to put pressure on the Syrians who have been trying to exercise increased power within Lebanon. A resolution that had some effect. And so the United States is continuing to act in a multilateral fashion at the United Nations when it is in United States interest and general principles of human rights to do so, period. And I think we'll see more of these as we go on, as on Darfur, as on Lebanon. There'll be more actions of this sort. And in cases which directly affect the security of the United States, there is definitely a possibility that if the United States has to go it alone to protect the homeland, it will.
And with that, we're out of time. Ken Weinstein at the Hudson Institute, thank you for joining us tonight. And Lee Feinstein at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you to you both. In a moment, the new National Museum of American Indians opens in Washington. This is On Point. The newest addition to the National Mall opened today in Washington with a procession of thousands representing Native American nations from across the country. The National Museum of the American Indian is the Smithsonian's 15th museum and the first dedicated to the history and cultures of indigenous groups of the Western Hemisphere. The $219 million museum houses over 8,000 objects and is expected to host over 4 million visitors a year. Here are sounds from the museum's opening ceremonies today in Washington.
Welcome.
Enchanted.
Scanos fuego.
Wariguano hela dunigaiga yotsa nunye chiganto de yungwatla winisla de.
Naha, nihi naha ban.
Today, Native America takes its rightful place on the National Mall in the very shadow of the nation's Capitol building itself.
Today, we pay special tribute to the courage and determination of Native peoples of America.
Born from the roots of our past and the wisdom of our people, this Capitol is our plural culture. Synthesis of our accumulated knowledge of the centuries.
What a glorious day the grandfather spirit and creator of all things has given us. Only 400 years after the old world collided with their world, the native people of this land became America's first endangered species. In spite of the sad truth, this beautiful structure is also a monument to the 190,000 American Indian veterans who served with honor and courage in our armed forces.
As the Mohawk have counseled us, it is hard to see the future with tears in your eyes. We have survived and from a cultural standpoint have even triumphed against great odds. We are here right now, 40 million indigenous people throughout the Americas and in hundreds of culturally distinct cultural communities. And we will insist that we remain a part of the cultural future of the Americas.
The Navajo people sing, in the house of long life, there I wander. In the house of happiness, there I wander. Beauty is before me, beauty is behind me. Beauty is above me and beauty is below me. Beauty is all around me, with it I wander. In old age traveling, with it I wander. On the beautiful trail am I, with it I wander.
So in the spirit of Chief Joseph, and at the opening of the National Museum of the American Indian, I say, on this September 21st, 2004, to those of you within sight and sound of this occasion, and who descend from those who came, welcome to Native America.
Voices and sounds from hundreds of performers and speakers today in Washington, including Oklahoma Representative Tom Cole, Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo, Colorado Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, and Richard West, Director of the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian, opening today in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.